wonderful, majestic world around us, it's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
Sweet.
Well, I'm glad you're confident, James. You're saying it's going to be a goodie, you know.
These topics really interest me. So we're starting off by talking about water disinfection. And I mean, this is something that's really important.
It is very, very important. So it's estimated that sort of between 2 and 4 billion people on the planet lack access to adequate sanitation, clean water, all of that sort of stuff, you know. So, you know, that's a basic human necessity, a human right, for goodness sake. So what we need to be able to do is to provide methods by which you can disinfect water, clean it up, purify it so that it's drinkable, so that it's usable for goodness sake, the majority of humanity. Now, obviously, easier said than done. These methods that you're going to use have got to be cheap. Number one, they've got to be easily done, transportable, all that sort of stuff. So there's many ways that you can purify water. Now, probably the most common one in New Zealand is chlorination. Chlorination is very effective. Unfortunately, it does leave or can leave behind residues, so it's not absolutely perfect. A better way, very possibly, is using hydrogen peroxide. Hydrogen peroxide, H2O2, which is a very widely used reagent for purifying water. Now, the problem is you're going to make this stuff, okay? So hydrogen peroxide doesn't grow on trees. You can make it from hydrogen and oxygen, not surprisingly, but there's sort of tricky ways of doing that. So the way that it works at the moment, essentially, is if you want large amounts of hydrogen peroxide, they will be made on site in a factory somewhere. You then need to transport this to wherever you want your clean water. Problem with that is hydrogen peroxide is inherently unstable, and so therefore what you then need to do is put stabilizers in your hydrogen peroxide, which does lower its reactivity and makes it less active towards all of the bugs in the water that you're trying to purify. So, long story short, these guys at Cardiff University in Wales and also some co-workers in Singapore and the USA, they were looking at ways of preparing hydrogen peroxide using a catalyst that is made of gold and palladium, two precious metals. And you might think, well, that's a bit silly because they're precious metals, so they're going to cost a lot. You don't need much of them. And they were busy sort of doing this. They were looking at this catalyst catalyzing the reaction between hydrogen and the oxygen in the air to form hydrogen peroxide. And while they were doing this, they found that the reaction mixture that they were making here, which was just thought to contain hydrogen peroxide, actually ended up being about 10 million to 100 million times better, more effective than actual hydrogen peroxide in killing these bugs.
That is insane.
It is. It is. And in fact, what they found was that, they were generating hydrogen peroxide, but on the way to generating hydrogen peroxide, they were making these things called reactive oxygen species. And if anybody knows a little bit of sort of biochemistry and stuff like that, you'll know that oxygen, good old oxygen in the air, can be turned into some nasty things in the body. So we can get things called hydroxyl radicals, or we can get hydroperoxyl radicals. They are extraordinarily reactive. They will just react with any old thing, okay? And that's the sort of stuff that you're looking for in purification of drinking water. You're looking for something that's really just going to go crazy on all of these bugs. And they found that, yep, that is what's happening. So they're using these gold palladium nanoparticles. And nanoparticles, as the name hopefully suggests, is really, really, really tiny, nano-sized, 10 to the minus 9 meters, particles that are made up of this gold and palladium. And as I say, you really don't need a hell of a lot. You only need a little bit there that can catalyze this reaction. And so that makes this potentially a method by which you can generate decent amounts of hydrogen peroxide. You can also use it directly in generating these reactive oxygen species. And so this could be a possible way where you can obviate the need to actually transport large amounts of hydrogen peroxide around the place that contain stabilizers that make it not as good as it otherwise would be. And you can also then avoid using chlorinated disinfectants, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, with all their attendant problems. So, you know, this sounds quite exciting. Yeah.
Let's hope for it. Let's hope that the world of water changes.
Well, it has to. There's only so much water on the planet, isn't there?
100%.
You know? So, yeah. It seems like a no-brainer, and, you know, good luck to them, and I hope it works. Yeah.
Well, Our next topic for this week, we're talking about stress and going grey. And Alan, you don't have any, you must be really stress-free. I can't see any grey hairs.
You have not been talking to my other half. Obviously, she gives me motto about going grey. So, you know, I think it must be the light I'm sitting in. Probably.
I do give my dad a lot of stick for having one or two grey hairs on the side of his head.
Yeah, well, you know, it's thought, and it's often believed, I guess, that grey hair is a result of stress, or can be as a result of stress. And this is one of those things that's often assumed but seldom demonstrated, in the words of my old PhD supervisor. And so some workers at Columbia University in the States, in New York, have sort of set out to test whether this is the case or not. And one of the things I really love about doing Dear Science is that I learn a hell of a lot. So, you know, I have to look up these things and, you know, pretend like I'm an expert on them, you know. And the one thing...
You are an expert.
But the one thing I found out about hair today is that once it's out of the follicle, it doesn't change colour. It cannot change colour. So as it comes out of the follicle, that's the colour that it is. Okay, so you're not going to go grey overnight, literally, okay, because your hair is already out of the follicle, so therefore it actually can't change colour. So the colour changes and everything occur while you're inside the hair follicle.
That's crazy. Yeah, but then we can change it ourselves by dyeing it.
But who would want to, really, honestly?
It's fashion.
I've been there, done that, I know, but we won't talk about that. So these workers at Columbia, basically what they did, they got 14 volunteers and they said, okay, we want you to keep a stress diary, and so that we've got some idea of how stressed you are. And we are then going to take samples of your hair at various times, and we're going to try and correlate those samples of your hair with the amount of stress that you are under. And we're going to use a fancy, fancy, fancy high-resolution scanner that is going to analyze slices of your hair that correspond to around about 1 hour's growth of hair. So you can imagine it's a tiny, tiny, tiny little bit. And this scanner is able to very, very precisely quantify the actual colour of the hair. So you're talking very, very sort of gradual shadings and stuff like that. And this can do that very, very nicely. So I guess the long and the short of it is what they found was that in periods of high stress, it appears that you go greyer. Okay, so something is happening inside your hair follicles. It's responding to stress and putting out hair that is grey-coloured. And what they found was, and this is the real kicker, is that this looks to be like a reversible process. So you take away the stress, you take away the grey. Ooh.
So I feel like there's so much more to this, because I was going to say, I feel like old people have stress-free life by the time they're older. I mean, I'm not there yet, so I can't really speak to this, but...
No. And you're absolutely right as well. And they made a point of this in the paper saying that, you know, don't, if you're 70 years old, for goodness sake, don't expect that, you know, if you're absolutely stress-free that, you know, everything's going to go back. But, you know, if your greyness is caused by stress, if you're starting spouting grey hairs because of stress, then if you take away the stress, then it's reversible. And they showed this by they put one person on holiday for 4 weeks, and they're monitoring 5 hairs on this person's head. And after the holiday, they found that what was previously grey was now coming out their normal colour. So, you know, I think that's kind of cool.
It's very cool.
Yeah.
Well, talking about holiday, we're going to head over to the English Channel, mm-hmm. where there was this big solar panel plane flown 40 years ago. I can picture this. I remember seeing photos of this. It's got these huge wings with all these solar panels over it. Yep. What's happening now?
Well, that's the thing. It's 40 years today that the first solar-powered aircraft flew across the English Channel by itself. Okay, powered only by solar panels, no batteries, no nothing like that. And not only did it just fly the channel, it threw 300 kilometres. So it flew from basically France to England. And it did that in 5.5 hours with 2 3-horsepower motors. 3 horsepower. I mean, anybody who watches Top Gear, you know, 500, 600 horsepower cars, they've got 3 horsepower motors.
It's not a lot.
And that's enough to get them across the channel. And you sort of think, well, hell, that happened 40 years ago. Where are we now with solar-powered flight? Because, you know, obviously one of the big contributors to carbon emissions is flight, international flight and everything. Is there a way that we can get around this? So in the intervening years, in 2015, 2016, there was a plane that actually flew around the world, a solar-powered plane. Okay, now this contained batteries as well. It took them a while. It took them 16 months, so they didn't do it all at once, obviously.
It's a long trip.
It's proof of principle, I guess. The average speed that they took was 70 kilometres an hour, so not exactly quick either. But again, you're proving that, you know, where there's a will, that this sort of thing can be done. And so in 2018, 3 years ago, so there was an unmanned plane from Airbus. And this flew, again, purely solar powered for 26 days straight. Okay? 26 days straight.
Wow.
Yeah, without landing. And the thing was, it was flying at extraordinarily high altitude. So it was 70,000 feet, which is about 20,000 meters or a little bit more than that. And so obviously, you know, there are things that we can do. This is all obviously in its infancy and everything like that. But hell, it's been 40 years since they actually flew the English Channel in a solar power plane. And in fact, it's 42 years since the first person did it pedal powered. Wow. In 1979, so a plane called the Gossamer Albatross did this with a guy basically sitting on a bike and pedaling.
Some good exercise.
And he flew the English Channel. And in fact, next year they are going to have a competition repeating that. And so there's going to be a prize for the first finisher of £50,000. So
nice.
It's kind of interesting. You know, it's amazing the things that we can do with solar power. Solar power is the future, people. There's absolutely no doubt about that. That's the way that humanity is going to survive. Yeah. Solar power has to be.
Sweet. Well, that was Dear Science.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
Thank you.